Right. Good afternoon, everyone. I hope seems like it's the first day of summer today. So much for the spring semester at this point. Few bullets about the last couple weeks of the class. Hopefully nothing surprising. Any questions on the upcoming logistics? Cool. So last time we were we moved from pipelining to out of order, again, sort of looking for opportunities to improve the performance of our processors by taking advantage of the fact that some instructions can execute before instructions that the programmer intended to happen later based on when data are ready. And we talked about a couple methodologies for sort of a way to implement that out of order design. This time and this week, we're sort of going to, in a sense, kind of revisit some of the designs that we've talked about this semester and look at how optimization can be beneficial from a performance standpoint, but can also come with some other costs that we also need to realize as engineers and system builders. Okay. Anything before we get started? Cool, so here's a function. Check passphrase, all right? Essentially, a function to check a password. And we're assuming that this variable, this passphrase, it's some internal variable that holds the actual correct passphrase. Any thoughts on this? Does it look okay? So what's this doing? So we have a while loop, right? We're basically going character by character. We're checking if the passphrase passed in matches each character of what we have stored, okay? And then when we get to the end of passphrase and we get to the null character, right, then we stop. This sounds reasonable, right? We're making sort of we require that both of these are sort of valid C strings with a null character. And so we keep doing that, and then eventually this while loop's gonna end, and then we check, okay, was the last thing the same? So basically, was the last thing we ended the loop because there was a mismatch or because it was actually correct, right? And then we're gonna return the result based on that. Thoughts? Look okay? Something has to be wrong. Why else would you be showing it? So this is a reasonable implementation for this, right? It should check that the passphrase is correct, and it only returns sort of a true or a positive if that's in fact the case, and it will reject bad passphrases. But how does it do that? So it's looping through the passphrase sort of character by character, and the first instance of a match, what happens? First instance of a mismatch, what happens? It returns, right? Because we know at that point, it doesn't matter. All of the other characters could be the same. That doesn't matter, the passphrase is still wrong, right? And so the effect of this is that the number of times this while loop is going to execute is proportional to the number of matching characters starting at the beginning. Which, again, sounds okay, but then thinking about this a little bit more, there's a problem there because depending on how long this function takes, even if we get the passphrase wrong, we still learn a little bit about, was part of the passphrase right? And so this is probably not what the author of this function intended, that if you just sort of try a bunch of times and then observe the timing, that that could give away what the actual stored passphrase is. So what could this look like? So imagine we try this, and we don't know what the first character is, so we try a bunch of attempts, and we change the first character each time, and then we observe how long it takes. Right? And then there's one of these here that seems to take a little bit longer than the others. Now, we probably can't just do this once. We probably have to try a few times to get a more accurate measurement, you know, just like we did with the timing homework at the beginning of the semester. But the one where there's a match, you know, was going to take a little bit longer. Now we know the first character. Okay, so we can go ahead and use that and then vary the second character. Right? And the one that takes a little bit longer is going to, over a few trials, is going to tell us likely what the second character is. And so without knowing the passphrase, without having a way to like inspect the actual memory or somehow, I don't know, you know, reverse engineer the code or anything, we're not even doing anything. We're just calling the function that we're allowed to call, timing it, and then using that to figure out the passphrase. So that's not great, even though from a performance point of view, like that exiting out of that while loop kind of made sense, right? Why bother doing a bunch more checks when you already know the passphrase is wrong? Any questions on this? Make sense so far? So where else do we see this? So what about something like the cryptographic operations we talked about, we're talking about making a secure channel. So the premise of how those are secure is that they use large numbers. Because with smaller numbers, it would be easier to brute force it. With larger numbers, that's not possible with today's computers. And so if we use sort of the right size numbers, we get the security properties we want. Now, the problem is that we might need to multiply, say, to 500-bit numbers, well, we don't have the hardware that will just do that for us. Because where would we stop, you know? So, like, the hardware provides something, and so we have to adapt to it. Well, to handle this, we can use the properties of multiplication. So if we want to multiply, say, just for example here, right, two 64-bit numbers where we could have potentially up to 128-bit output. Well, if we only have hardware that can handle a 64-bit output, we can break apart each of our values here, x and y, into sort of the upper portion and lower portion, upper portion and lower portion, and then take those two sums, multiply across, and we get the four individual sums that we add together, but each multiply then is smaller and fits on our hardware. And then by the time we sum that up, we get our original intended result. And I think if you look at this, you'd be like, oh, okay, yeah, that makes sense. Okay, that's reasonable. But the number of actual multiplication operations here now depends on the size of our number. Right? Because with these two numbers now, we have these four operations, and with other size values, we're going to have more or fewer operations. And so again, we get this effect where depending on what we're actually trying to do, it changes what we're going to see from our hardware. And when we do more work, we're going to see it take longer. And so again, is this a problem? Like, sure, okay, yeah, doing more work takes longer. What's the big deal? Well, again, so when we're using this for the cryptographic layers, right, these highly important layers that protect the security, this can be problematic because sometimes what's driving how long the computation takes is actually the private key, which, as we know, is supposed to be kept secret. Once somebody learns your private key, now a lot of the guarantees that we saw disappear. And so starting in the early 2000s, researchers started to look at this type of problem. And this paper by Brumley and Bonet found that with OpenSSL, so a production, widely used library for doing cryptographic operations, you could attack it using these kinds of ideas. And so what they found was that even across a network, right? So the title of this paper is Remote Timing Attacks. So not even on the same machine, but on a network of machines, if they made a specific type of request to the library running on another machine, based on how long it took for different computations to execute, they could then figure out what the private key must be on that machine that's being involved in those computations, which is exactly what you don't want. Right? We don't want to be able to learn what the private key is. And so because of how long operations of multiplication and modulus were taking, and those were dependent on both the input, which the attacker can generally control, and the secret internal private key, they could figure this out. And so there's a figure in the paper that looks something like this, and sort of the key takeaway here is that the y-axis is time difference. So basically, whether or not the private key had a 1 or a 0 in a particular bit, the execution would be very different. And it was sort of noticeably so. And so again, by trying many iterations with well-chosen inputs, they could then figure out the keys, the bits of the key to figure out the private key. So this is one of the challenges that can arise here. We're trying to keep something secret, and maybe the timing kind of works against us. Any questions? All right, it doesn't have to just be timing, right? We can think of another example. So if we think of a web browser, so the purpose of a web browser is essentially to provide kind of like a virtual machine-like thing for each web page, right? We want to be able to load something in a browser tab or browser window and load something else, and they're separate, right? They can't interfere with the underlying machine. They can't interfere with each other. They also shouldn't even learn that you're loading the other web page. We like this for privacy reasons. However, right, if you think about one of the design decisions for a browser, right, so we have links, it's kind of helpful to mark that, like, this link here, we've already used, right? We visited that page before. Now it's convenient for us to know, like, oh, okay, I already looked at this one, I'm still searching, so I'll try this other one. Whatever. Okay, that's fine, but when you couple that with the ability for a web page to include JavaScript, that can also then, say, inspect the page that the browser rendered and say, look for that particular link and then query its color, right? And then check, okay, wait, is it the sort of original color that I expect for a link that they haven't visited, or is it the color that the browser changes it to when it has been visited? And I'll just sort of keep that knowledge for whatever purpose, right? I can do whatever I want with the fact of knowing that, the user clicked this link. So again, this isn't something where like the browser like provides an API for this information or the other web page is sharing it. It's sort of through this other mechanism. Now we can think about how we might prevent this, right? So a browser might realize this and be like, well, wait a minute, okay. Like, we're gonna allow that API to exist where you can check the color, but we're just gonna lie to you, right? So regardless of whether it's clicked, it's gonna look the same. And so you won't be able to tell if the person clicked it, or sort of limit how we can style the thing so that this difference isn't as clear. That makes sense? So again, not really timing, but another sort of way to learn more than we should. But like a lot of these things, sometimes there's a simple version and then we can kind of build on it. So again, the idea of the browser is that the web pages are separate. They don't learn about each other. But what if, let's say, you have a web page, you write some code, JavaScript, let's say, inside of it, and you use that to populate a large array. Okay, you know, who knows? Maybe there's some valid reason for doing this. Now, to do that, what's gonna happen? Well, the browser is gonna have to do a bunch of memory writes, right, to fill that that underlying array somewhere in memory with whatever data you're asking it to. But like we've talked about throughout this class, one of the main goals is that we want to take a single machine and share it in multiple ways, right? Whether it's multiple processes or threads, whether we have one core or multiple cores, we might have to share memory. We want this illusion that we get access, but we really don't. We're really sharing this underlying hardware. And so when our web page tries to write this large array, it's gonna take some time, but it's also gonna depend on what else is happening. Because if something else is, say, using the memory at the same time, well, we might have to wait. Which, you know, is fine. Right? That's kind of the whole premise, that we are willing to make that trade-off. We're willing to say, yes, I will sometimes have to wait to run my program, but in exchange, hey, isn't it nice that we can have multiple things running on the same computer? Right? And I don't have to like launch one web page and then sort of like restart the whole computer into another web page. Like I can run multiple things at the same time. That's great. That's the whole point. But there's a downside. So this is a paper from a couple years ago looking at, well, what happens if I load different web pages while doing this large array write? Right, so here's a couple examples. So what ends up happening is that something like the New York Times, where it's gonna be a little bit more static, a little bit more text-based, is going to have sort of less of an impact on my ability to write that array quickly. Compared to something like weather.com, loading like maybe a radar image or something else that's a little bit more intensive, that's actually gonna slow my writing down quite a bit. And because when we load a web page, we expect that it's gonna be kind of about the same as it was. You know, web pages don't sort of drastically change every time you open them. And so this idea of a signature kind of evolves where every time you load New York Times, while this array is happening, it sort of has the similar kind of effect. And so that these signatures can then be detected, right? So you can look at how that array performance is happening and then use that to try to figure out like what other web page was being loaded. So this is, again, another example of this timing issue where the execution time of one thing changes depending on what else is going on, Does this make some sense? All right. So if we kind of generalize this, right, this is the notion of what we call a side channel, right? These different ways that we are observing what's happening in a way that's indirect, right? We're not doing it through the normal mechanisms of, like, explicitly reading memory contents or looking at the output in a file. We're sort of observing how the machine is operating and using that to infer what's going on. And there's a few different kind of common ways that this happens. So timing that we've been sort of talking about is one of them. So basically, like, how long something takes might change depending on what else is going on. One issue that we won't talk about explicitly, but is kind of similar, is this notion of power draw. So if you think about a processor executing, right, it needs energy to do that. And depending on how many circuits are active or how compute intensive a particular operation it is, it's going to change how much energy that processor needs. And so you can correlate, well, if the processor is using the power draw curve looks like this, then it must be in this mode. That's another way to sort of figure out what's going on without sort of directly observing it. Right, and we see this all the time, you know, because, like, your phone or your laptop gets hot. Well, it's because it's doing more, right? It's using more energy, and that's sort of a symptom of something that's happening on the device. And then the third one, electromagnetic radiation. So anytime we have current flowing, we're also generating electromagnetic field, and that can be varied depending on exactly what's happening. Again, the way that current is flowing in a particular chip. There's other cases, like, for example, sound. So, like, different key presses having different noises, or a spinning hard drive causing sort of different sound characteristics depending on what's happening. Now, of course, right, of course a processor is going to use more energy, or of course if we're doing more, things are going to take longer. And so a side channel on itself isn't that unexpected. The issue is that sometimes it can reveal things that we either want to keep secret or we want to keep private. And that's where it becomes a problem that we have to consider as engineers. Because even though whatever, like, the, say, encryption operation we know is correct, if there's a side channel, then maybe the guarantees that we thought we had, we don't quite have. All right. Any questions on the idea of a side channel? Okay, so we're going to look at a couple more examples of this today. But I do think it is worth kind of thinking about this a little bit more, right? This notion of leaking information, whether it's like which browser. What other web page your browser's loading, or whether or not you're on the right track for a password. You know, we have to think, okay, these side channels are going to exist, and we'll see some examples of them. Now, they're probably not intentional, but we do have to sort of make a judgment. Is it worth fixing? How hard is it to fix? What's the trade-off if we eliminate that side channel? Right, because, like, in the passphrase case, okay, so we just need to not exit early, right? So no matter what, we want to have a fixed execution time no matter what guess you make. Okay, that's going to slow things down. You okay with that? Probably for the password checking, I would say so, right? Like, that's probably worth it. But if, say, in the web browser case, if we can avoid those signature attacks, but every web page now loads, I don't know, 10% slower. You making that trade-off? You know, there's not going to be like a, you know, a slide in here that's going to tell you the answer. Like, okay, here's when you decide to or not, right? This is where things get, you know, much more subjective. And, you know, we as engineers have to sort of make decisions. Like, how do we balance sort of performance, quality of experience for users, and security and privacy? Because those are generally going to be a little bit in conflict all the time. There's not usually like the one obvious solution that maximizes all of those things. That's generally speaking quite difficult. So we have to make decisions. And so I think we should keep that in mind when we're thinking about side channels, is that it's not always so obvious exactly what to do. Okay. So we had the problem. So we had this problem with memory, right? We said, okay, memory is really slow. Let's put a cache in front of it. That way we can hide the long time it takes to go all the way to, say, DRAM by, if we get, you know, in a good case, we'll have something stored in the cache, we can just access it there and our program would be faster. Okay, so we do that, right? Now we have this array, it's got a bunch of elements in it, and we measure how long it takes to read the, access these different elements of the array, okay? And so for what we see for most of them, right, they're about the same, but then we get this one here, which takes 5, 6, 7 times longer. So given what we know about memory, we could go, oh, well, okay, yeah, sure. You know, that kind of makes sense, right? This array is big enough, it's gonna span multiple cache blocks, and so it makes sense that we'll have some parts of it could be in the cache and, you know, other that part wasn't, right? Because even though from our program's point of view, it's kind of this one contiguous array, from the processor's point of view, it's just another memory location. And so part of it's in the cache, part of it's not. And of course, the part that's not in the cache is gonna take longer. You know, 3 weeks ago, you'd have been perfectly fine with this. In light of today's discussion, however, this could be potentially problematic. So let's look at an example here. And so we have a little bit of pseudocode that kind of illustrates the point that we'll kind of use and tweak in various ways throughout today. But just to kind of break this down. So we're starting, we have this array. It's sized so that it matches the size of our cache. Okay, that's fine. Next, we have this operation, access all of array. So what's that gonna do? Why is that there? Any thoughts? Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So we're going to ask the processor to access all parts of that array, which is going to have the effect of maybe it's in memory, maybe it's already in the cache, but the processor is going to try to cache that on our behalf. And because we're sort of strategic about our array size, right, we sort of expect to fill the cache with our data from that array. So this is essentially going to pull everything into the cache. Okay, now we have this sort of other access. So we have some memory access at some address, and we're gonna increment whatever the data stored at that pointer is. Okay, nothing, that's fine. That's pretty straightforward. And then finally, our fourth operation here, we're gonna go back, we're gonna try to access our array, and then we're gonna time how long that takes. And so let's say during this, so we do this timing operation, and we find that this particular array index, so array at 128, is slower to access than the other indices of this array. OK? Okay, so why? Well, you know, kind of given our setup here, it makes sense that if this other address, the reference to that place in memory and modifying that memory, was then loaded into the cache and evicted wherever array 128 was, as we would expect based on what we know about caches, then when we go back and access array 128, it's no longer in the cache. We have to go all the way to main memory. It takes longer. Make sense? Good with that? So given what we know about caches, what can we say about other address with respect to this array 128 lookup? Any thoughts? So what if we look at, what if we start with this middle column here? All right. What do you think? Do we know something about how the cache indices relate or not? Yeah. Okay. So they should have the same cache index. Okay. Now, if we switch over to the tag, what, do we know anything about the tag? Yeah. Okay. Different tag. All right. Okay. So does this make sense? So if they have the same cache index, what's going to happen? Well, when they map to whatever particular row in the cache that is, if the index is the same, that's where we're going to get the eviction, right? Because whatever was there for the processor to pull in the other thing, it's going to have to replace it. And so, yes, we'd absolutely expect that the cache index is the same. But what about the tag? Why does the tag have to be different? Yeah. Right, so if the tag was the same, that would make it a cache hit, right? Same index, tag matches, you know, assuming it's valid, right, and all that. Like, yeah, great, we have a cache hit, and so now it wouldn't be evicted, right? And so the only way we would get something evicted is if the index is the same, but the tag is different, so we know that. Okay. And what about the offset? Is the offset the same or different? Okay, so the offset's the same because because we only have the, sort of this one that's affected array 128, and it's a array of characters, then the block must, you know, basically it's a block of one byte. So I think that if we knew that the blocks were, well, okay, so if the blocks were that small, then there is no cache offset, so they have to be the same. But this doesn't really specify, and maybe I was a little bit sloppy with how I described this. You know, maybe array 128 was slower to access, and array 129 was slower to access too, or something like that. And so actually within the cache block itself, we can't tell, right? So we don't know if they have exactly the same or not, because the granularity we're observing is based on that cache block size. And so this one, we can't really say if they're the same or not. They might be the same, they may not be, but we know that they're going to correspond to the same block. Okay. Any questions on this? Okay, so I'm guessing that some of you are like, okay, yeah, sure, I get this, right? Because like we talked about caches, okay, I get the evict thing. However, there is something a little bit odd here, right? Because we're talking about like this program at kind of this abstract pseudocode level, but then we're going all the way to caches. Like, aren't there a bunch of things happening between there? And there are. And so if you're kind of wondering, like, wait a minute, how do these things connect? We've learned about more layers here in this class, which is true. And so this is kind of the disclaimer slide that there are additional complications. So the cache operating on physical addresses, but the program operating on virtual addresses. So there's going to be some mapping there that the program's going to have to deal with. Sometimes this is easier because the OS is often going to allocate these sort of predictable in-order pages. There's, of course, other things happening, right? If we're calling a function, then we're accessing the stack. Other things going on in the program, which is going to affect memory and what's being loaded. So that's also a potential challenge. And so we need to deal with, like, and we're often going to then try to observe the system whether we're doing the thing or not, to try to get kind of a baseline. There's also another challenge that's called prefetching. And so kind of as the name implies, the idea here is that a processor is going like, well, huh, so if this program is accessing this memory and then this memory, well, it's probably going to access this next memory too, right? And so why don't I just go ahead and start fetching that into the cache before it even asks? Because that will then make things faster. And so that can change how these caches are filled. And so we can try to avoid that by how we set this up. Some caches aren't necessarily using index bits, might use a hash to determine the row, and so that's also going to affect things. So if you were kind of wondering, like, wait a minute, there's definitely seems like this is more complicated than kind of this, like, simple, one-to-one correspondence, you're right. And so the thing to keep in mind is that, you know, we might be sort of looking at a simple example, but generally speaking, do this in the real world, and we have a couple examples, it's going to require a few trials. And so it's not just going to happen on sort of a one shot, like you just do one lookup and one timing. We're probably going to have to measure it a bunch of times to try to compensate for a lot of these effects and then also set things up in a way that deals with it. So this is kind of the disclaimer, and then we're going to go back to sort of thinking about kind of the fundamentals. Was there any questions about this? So let's kind of expand this idea a little bit. So we have kind of a similar setup here, right? We're allocating an array. We're going to line it to the size of our cache, and then we're doing that sort of access all the array or load the cache so that the cache is going to be full of sort of our known values. Okay. Then we get this next little section here. And this is going to be sort of a placeholder for something happening in the system that we can't directly observe. Hence the mystery. So this isn't like a variable that we could just print the value of, right? This could be something like a function call where we're allowed to call it, but we can't like inspect the internal state of it. It could be something else happening in the system that we can trigger somehow, or we just know when it's about to happen. And so this is kind of a way to sort of represent that something else is happening that we can't directly observe. However, we are going to assume something, right? So we're going to assume that there's this memory access where we're going to modify the memory pointed to by pointer, by incrementing it. All right. Then after that, we get back to our sort of timing, where we're going to look for, okay, how long does it take to access this particular memory between, from going from loading the cache, this mystery thing happening or not, and then checking how long it took, or how long it takes to now access that same data. All right, so if we know that pointer is at a particular address and we have this particular cache, what array index should we check to see if this is happening? Let's take maybe 3 or 4 minutes, consult your neighbors, and then we'll come back and discuss. All right, so how do we solve this? So first, I think we want to understand our cache. So if we have 64 byte blocks, how many bits do we need for the offset? Anyone? I see a couple sixes. Okay, right, so this is going to be 2 to the 6, and then, so what, 2 to the 15, that means we have 2 to the 9, and 9 bits for the index. Okay, so with that, now we can look at our pointer and figure out, okay, which row of the cache, like what was the index of that pointer, and what row do we have to care about? And so if we look at this in binary, just the kind of the last 2 bytes here, you get something like that. Now, so that's going to be our offset, and then we need 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 for our index. Okay. And so our goal, right, is our goal is to make the index sort of match. Now, because our array starts aligned to the cache size, then the first sort of address, the first element, the address of the first element of the array is going to be at index 0. And so if we want to match this index, we're going to need to keep the index the same. So 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0. Now, we can just look at sort of any part of that block. So we can just set the offset to 0. And then if we look at this in hex, we're going to end up with 0, 8, 1, 0. And so if we do this, array at that, so that index into the array, that's basically going to correspond to a memory lookup that's going to have the same index, and therefore check, did this pointer write happen? In which case, then it's going to cause our thing to be evicted, and this is going to be slower, or not, and then this will be below that threshold. Any questions on that? All right. And the slides kind of walk through this as well. Now, as sort of an aside to this, what we've looked at is, okay, what are we sort of really learning here? So because we're looking at the cache timing, and if that memory access has happened and we get the eviction, then our cache timing is definitely going to change. So we're going to be able to tell that. Now, from a programmer's point of view, if we know the thing inside the if statement has happened, then we also know that the mystery has happened, right? The mystery must have been true or whatever, whatever caused the body of that if statement that we're kind of representing there, that case must have happened, right? That's how if statements work. But what do processors do? So remember, the processor has to decide, like, is that branch for that if check going to be taken or not? If it predicts that it's taken, it's going to start trying to execute what's inside of the if statement. And if it turns out that that was wrong, it has to go back and fix that. And so it better not change the memory at the end of the day, but it still might change the cache timing as the processor was anticipating doing that. Does that make sense? And so we can't quite tell what really happened internally because of that speculation. So that we'll kind of revisit this on Thursday. So another example here, if we have, again, we still have sort of our array the same way, same kind of setup here, except now, you know, the access is slightly different. or what we're checking for to see, you know, did this affect our timing is slightly different. And we happen to know that that other array starts at that address, 0x200400. So we run this, we check on it, we find out that the array index 0x800 is the one that was kind of interesting, right? Something was different. So can we use that to figure out mystery? So let's take a couple minutes, see if you can reason through, based on that, what could mystery be? All right, let's see if we can figure out what mystery was. So again, our goal is we need to figure out how do we get a conflict of the same cache row. And so we know that array 0 has a cache index of 0 because it's aligned. Now, our index of 0x800, if we write that out, in binary, it looks like that. And so we still have our 6 bits for the offset. And then our So we got let's see here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Okay. For the index bits. Okay. And so if we map that into hex, we're going to get 0x20. So that's the index we care about, is hex 20. Now, how do we get that from the other array? Well, the other array is starting at that. So if we write that out, so that's the the binary of the sort of the lower digits here. Again, we have our offset. And index. And so this index is 0x10, right? Instead of 0x20. So we need something that we can add to this that will give us the same index. And so to do that, we're going to need to add that to the index. So we're going to add 0x10 to the index, but then of course we have to have our offset bits here. Whoops, how'd that happen? Oh no. What happened? Okay, I don't know what happened. Sorry about that. All right, so we had and we need to add this. But we have to fill in our lower bits here. And so this is 0, 0 that we can add. But that's just sort of one value for mystery, right? Because our offset bits aren't going to matter. So really these can be anything. And so we could have something like as well, because that's going to map to that same index. Sorry, the same cache row. It'll have the same index. So even if the setup is a little bit different and we're starting from a different place, our goal, again, is just to have that same, interfere with the same cache row, and we can figure out how that is structured. Any questions? So this is basically the value of I that got us inside this if statement. So we put that in for I here, and then because that if statement evaluated to true, then we said, okay, that's something interesting. So that's all that corresponds to. All right. So that's, again, a breakdown of it. Okay, but, you know, you might be thinking, like, well, okay, this is, like, fine, you know, but so far we've just been looking at this direct map cache. That was kind of that simple thing we talked about first. What about a different cache design, something a little bit more complicated that gives more flexibility, right? Because direct map cache, nice property where everything has kind of one spot. But if we had an associative cache, now we suddenly have multiple spots we could put it. So can we handle that? So if we look at something like this, and now we have a two-way cache, can we make this work? So I'll give you a couple minutes to think about that. So if we can make this work, what needs to be true about the array lookup with respect to the cache for index one to the array index with array lookup with index two? Do we want the same cache index or different? Any takers for same? Okay, a couple. Any takers for we want something different? Okay, a couple. All right. So if we kind of drew out like a simple two-way cache here, obviously I'm not going to draw all of the rows here, but you know, we have a couple. And so if these two lookups are have different cache indices. So let's say the first lookup actually ends up here, so index one and index. I'm just using that as kind of a way to refer to that. So if the cache like were to start empty, we might kind of have something that looks like that, right? Depending on you know what it's going to be, but it's going to be two different rows. We know that for sure, right? Because the indices, the cache index are different. And so now with that, if this memory access, this pointer does happen, and let's say it happens to map to the same index here, and so this is our mystery pointer, well, it can go into the cache just fine, right? Because we have a two-way set associative cache, and so the one index fits in one place, and the other one, it can fit there, and so even when we go and check this again here, right? It could still be in the cache. And so what we want actually is for not these to be at different cache indices. We want them to be at the same one. And so that way index one and index two both map to the same row. So we know that whatever happened with our update policy, wherever this got put, we'll try both of those ways. Okay, so we want the cache index the same. What about the tag? What do we want for the tag between the two index one, index two lookups? Thoughts on same? Thoughts about different? All right, so we got some takers for different, right? And so why do we want those to be different? Well, we want to ensure that they are going to have to use different blocks in the cache. Because if the tag was the same, like we said before, then they'll just be hits on each other, and we'll only end up using one of the ways. We won't use both. So we definitely need the tag to be different. So the cache tag has to be different. Okay, so how do we make this happen? Well, again, so with our lookup here, we still have 64-byte blocks. So if we can still have our offset here. But now because we have two ways, we're going to have 8-bit for the cache index. So we'll have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And then this last bit here, we can use as our differentiating tag and still be within our array. So we were going to want to try 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. So this could be, say, index 1. And then for index 2, we need to flip that bit so we get a different tag. All right, so we have the same index in both, so we'll definitely hit the same cache row as the mystery pointer, or the mystery operation. But our tag will be different, so we'll ensure that we'll evict both of them, and then we'll be able to measure this. Okay, any questions on this? Just draw this arrow. This is that. All right. So what we've seen a few examples of, whether we have how the mystery event is showing up or what type of cache we have, this general flow where we want to first set up our cache in sort of a known way, do the thing we can't observe directly, and then try to look at our cache again and see what's changed. And so this was termed prime plus probe in the literature when sort of this type of attack was being developed. And this isn't the only way to do this, but it's sort of what we've been observing so far. And this was originally explored in looking at how attacks against AES encryption. So AES is a symmetric key algorithm. It's still widely used today. But again, back in the early 2000s, the implementation, or one implementation, used lookup tables. So what would happen is you would take your input data that you want to encrypt. The encryptor would have the secret key, the symmetric key like we talked about. And then depending on the key and the input data, you'd look up at a different spot in the lookup table to do the encryption operation. So the attack is, well, if we can set up a cache in a certain way, we know the input data because we're asking it to be encrypted, but we don't know the secret key, or the secret symmetric key. But then we can observe how that lookup table is changing what's in our cache. We can then figure out the key. Now, again, like unlike the examples that we've been looking at, you can't just do this like one time and just figure it out. This requires like thousands, many, many trials to do. But with enough observations, you can actually figure out what the key was. And so from the paper, there's this example where they sort of measured this attack on a real device. And this kind of highlights the some of that complexity. So the what's figure on the left, that's the timing. The x-axis is the different cache rows. And then the color corresponds to how long the accesses take. And so darker is actually shorter, lighter is longer. And so as you can see, on just the sort of the raw data, it varies quite a bit. Because again, there's other things going on, like accessing the stack and different effects in the raw data. But once you sort of get a baseline understanding of how the different cache rows should behave and subtract that out, you get what's on the right. And so now you get sort of this much more consistent, except for that diagonal that you can see, which is a little bit lighter. And that corresponds to the effect of the particular key changing the timing of the cache after the encryption operation. And so this is, again, it's a sort of a real-world example of this. And what this means is that these cryptographic libraries have to be very, very careful to not have these types of issues. And so you often hear this expression, don't write your own crypto library. And the reason is because there's sort of these mistakes that happen by, again, very, very talented people, but sort of not realizing this was possible. And so we learn from this and we improve our methods and we avoid failures like this. But it's very difficult to incorporate all of that understanding. And so that's why it takes a lot of work to write in a properly secure cryptographic library. Okay, so there's one more example in the slides. I will leave that to you. And then we will pick up on Thursday, going back to this idea of what happens with these branch mispredictions. All right, see you then.